Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hi, welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Heather, and I'm the chair of this week's podcast. And today we'll be talking about crowdfunding. I'm joined this week by Steph, Linda, Teresa, Nicola and Pat.
Hello.
Hi.
In the 18th century, they called it publishing by subscription. Now we call it crowdfunding. And we will be interviewing Claire Lyman, whose book Unscripted is to be published by Unbound, Xander Cassell, who was head of digital at Unbound, and Catherine McNamara, whose short story collection was published by Unbound. I read the crowdfunded book, An 18th Century Revival by Norma Clark, and I recommend it to anyone who's thinking of going down this route. Alexander Pope's translation of the Iliad of Homer was published with the help of subscribers in 1715. Just goes to show there's nothing new under the sun. This week, Linda will be reading from her work in progress. Nicola's going to educate us, and probably amuse us. And Teresa and Patsy Collins are going to tell us what's on their bedside table. First, over to Frank Carver, who's going to ask us,
name the novel.
Hi, Right Clubbers. I'm Frank Carver. I'm a huge fan of Right Club, the podcast, and I've listened to every episode. I'm delighted to have a go myself. I hope the book I've chosen is neither too tough nor too easy. I'll start with a relatively straightforward clue. The book was the author's debut novel. It was published in 2009 and 2012. I'll explain why two dates later. The story begins in 2005, and the first short paragraph is as follows. You might think he could have made up his mind earlier and been man enough to tell the others of his decision, but Alan Carlson had never been given to pondering things too long. Not a lot to go on there, I'm afraid. I have recorded this ahead of time, so I'll have to imagine the sound of scribbling, ah-haing, or perhaps puzzled shaking of heads.
Yep.
That's the sound you're looking for, Frank.
Yep.
The puzzled shaking of
heads.
Well,
I've got a feeling I know Alan Carson. I've got a feeling.
Right.
I don't know why it would have been published twice, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm going to need more clues.
Yeah. Right, well, let's get clue two from Frank then. Over to you again, Frank.
With any luck, you didn't all get it on the first clue, so here's some more. Some reviewers have likened this book to Forrest Gump for the way it weaves fiction in and out of history, while one review on Amazon calls it the anti-Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. When it was released, it became a huge bestseller, with the original version selling over 3 million copies by 2012. It became a film in 2013. Did any of that help?
No.
No, it didn't help at all.
No, I think the word you're looking for is none of us got it.
Right.
Forrest Gump weaving in and out of history.
The anti-dragon tattoo. 3 million copies, we should know this.
Yeah, we should.
Anti-dragon tattoo.
Alan Carson.
And a film.
Yeah.
No. You've got us so far, Frank.
Stumped. Let's hear clue three.
If you know the book at all, this clue should give it away, I hope. Told mainly in flashback, the story mixes the protagonist's long memories of events throughout the 20th century with a humorous and largely implausible foreground crime story. Several significant historical figures make appearances, including Franco, Harry S. Truman and Stalin, as well as fictional figures such as Einstein's klutzy brother Herbert. In the present of the story, we meet the staff and residents of an old people's home, a selection of incompetent gangsters and an elephant. That's three clues. Please tell me that at least one of you's got it.
I think I've got it. Is it the 100-year-old
man who climbed out of the window?
Oh.
Yeah. Grief. Is it?
I think it might be. I can't remember. Yeah.
That's a well-known bestseller.
No, it is.
Oh, it was a bestseller, yeah.
I think it was a book club book for me.
I read it. It was excellent.
Yeah.
Right, well, let's see if we're right, Frank.
As I hope some of you have worked out, the book is The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out of the Window and Disappeared by Jonas Jonasson.
Oh, that was good. That was tough, but I got it on the last clue.
I got it on the last clue.
I didn't remember the author's name, but well done, Frank.
Yeah.
I've been hiding under a bushel. I've never heard of it.
I've never heard of it either.
Oh, well, we've read it, haven't we?
Yes, I've got a copy, actually, if you want to read it.
I think mine's on the Kindle.
Right.
Originally written in Swedish, the book was such a worldwide success that it was soon translated into English, hence the two publication dates. I won't try to pronounce the Swedish title, though. Jonasson has so far produced a sequel, The Accidental Further Adventures of the Hundred-Year-Old Man, and two follow-ups, The Girl Who Saved the King of Sweden and Hitman Anders and the Meaning of It All. While all of these are selling well, none of them have hit the heights of the original book. The film version, which stars the funniest man in Sweden, has had mixed reviews. Film reviewer Mark Kermode wrote, "Swedish humour appears to travel less well." So it's a surprise that the book was so wildly successful. There's apparently a second film adaptation in production, due to feature Will Ferrell, if IMDb is to be believed. Thank you for listening.
Well, thank you, Frank. That was a good one.
Yeah, that was excellent. Well, we'll have some more of those.
The funniest man in Sweden.
Yeah. Or not.
We'd love some more readers to send us.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
Okay, over to Linda, who's going to read from her work in progress.
Okay, we're back to Mary Magdalene. This letter will come earlier than the parts I've read here, I think, the last couple of times. In this, they still haven't lost their money or whatever. So, she's writing to Dear Aunt Sugar. I miss you, and I wish you'd come with us. I have a lot to tell you about what all has happened since we left Papa. Not all of it is good. First off, we drove along for a couple of days and we were having a pretty good time. Eli seemed to be right happy driving along. It still doesn't seem real, him actually wanting to go after he had been stubborn as a blue-nosed bull about not going for so long. Do you think it's odd? I felt like you didn't want to talk about it much. But then I put that down to you being sad about me leaving. Well, I'm finally getting to see the world. I made Eli stop when we got to the Kentucky state line because it was the first time I ever left the state of Virginia. I got so excited, I said, I wish I had me a Kodak camera so I could take a picture to send to you. The second day, we came up on another site I had never seen before. It was a carnival just off Highway 28. I'd never seen the like of it. The first thing we did was to buy us some cotton candy. It was a blob as big as my head. Well, I took a little bite at first because I didn't know what it might taste like. And the minute it hit my mouth, it just disappeared. It just melted away and only left a little blob of sugar on my tongue. And it was good. Next, we walked around some, and you never heard the like of noise. There was music, little tinkly music, real cheery, and about 1,000 people talking and laughing, and carny men, parens, that's the ones that run the little booths where you can play games, if you don't know, yelling to people to get them to come to their booth. Eli decided to play a game where you shoot little tin ducks crossing a pond. If you shot 3 and they stayed down, you got to pick a prize. Sure enough, Eli got 3 down the first time. I picked a little fuzzy yellow duck with an orange bill. Eli wanted me to get a giant teddy bear. You know how impractical he is. I reminded him that we didn't have room for such. Next, we rode a Ferris wheel. Eli thought I might be scared, but I wasn't. He ought to know better, but then he didn't raise me as much as you did. When we got up to the top, which felt like you were a mile high, I could see everything near and far. The bad part was when we came upon a tent set back from the rest, where a woman with a dress on that showed everything she had was strutting around like a hussy. The carny man said she was Egyptian, and Eli couldn't take his eyes off of her. It cost $5 to go inside the tent to see the show she put on, and Eli wanted to go. I said it would cost a total of $10 for us to go in, and I wasn't about to spend that kind of money to see some nasty woman wiggle her butt. He did, though. I guess that doesn't surprise you. I remember when you said men would rather chase after a pretty woman than eat fried chicken. Ha ha. I was really mad at him for going in there and spending $5, and he fussed at me for being tight-fisted, which he does a lot.
yesterday, he said, he bet I wouldn't spend the nickel to see Jesus Christ riding a bicycle. I decided I wasn't going to stay mad because we had been having one of the best times we ever had together. And here's another bad thing. Eli is so careless with our money. I have to keep an eye on what we spend. When I wouldn't go in to see the show, he handed me $5 bills and told me to do what I wanted to. But when I looked at them in the light, it was not $5, but $3 $1 and $2 $20 bills. It worries me the way he gets carried away with things. There's a lot more, but the post office is about to close. When I know a town we're going to be in ahead of time, I will let you know so you can send me a letter to that post office and I will get it. I miss you and I wish you were here. Love, Mary Magdalene.
Very good, yeah. Jesus Christ riding a bicycle.
I'd pay money to see that.
Yeah. Well, she would because she's too mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was lovely, and Mary Magdalene's voice is there, and there's the cracking lines and all the rest of it, but it seems to be retelling parts of the story that you've already told.
Yeah, I wasn't sure where this fits in the novel.
Yeah,
because I didn't know if there was anything new in it. Mm-hmm. And the carnival scene we had before, uh-huh, which uses something, you know, about the Egyptian woman and everything, it was funnier to me
because it's
than her telling the story.
Yeah,
to her
much more vivid, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I thought it repeats what we already know, and somehow it needs to add something new.
Yeah,
it loses its punch. Yeah.
Are you thinking that it could be a regular recurring feature, her writing to Aunt Sugar?
Yes, I agree with you all that it was repeating things that you've already read about. Mm-hmm. And so I want her to be able to write to Aunt Sugar throughout because she needs to be keeping in touch.
Well, you could tell the whole novel that way if you chose to do it. But it's a different thing giving her this direct speech, isn't it?
It'd be a useful way to, we've been talking about how to cover things that Mary Magdalene wouldn't have seen as a, it could be a useful way.
The things
way
that she doesn't understand.
Yeah, so she could be writing to her aunt to talk about those things and her aunt could write back to her. So as long as you kept the letter short, you could have a running dialogue between the two of them as they go.
The thing that I thought might be new information is in the second paragraph, it still doesn't seem real, him actually wanting to go after he'd been stubborn as a blue-nosed bull about not going for so long. And I thought, that's a little bit of new information, I think. And do we know, I know that you've discussed this with us about why he suddenly decides he does want to leave town, but has that come up in the novel so far? Is that in the story? Or
it has, you haven't seen the first chapter yet.
Right.
The opening, but I thought by putting that here and saying, I felt like you didn't want to talk about it much, but then I put that down to you being sad about my leaving. And I thought then that somehow that might reflect that Aunt Sugar had been talking to someone else about it. But I haven't worked it out. I've got to work on it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It could be a useful way of Aunt Sugar disseminating information to me.
It could be a useful device. Yeah. I mean, I thought that, again, was quite touching, where she said, I just put that down to you being sad about me leaving. And I think she's projecting onto somebody who may not have felt that at all, but she's, she just assumed you must be sad because I'm going away.
I like that bit a lot.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely her voice.
And I think using a letter could be quite effective.
But I've got to figure out how to use the letters without having it repeat stuff. But when she writes, I think...
Well, maybe her, but how she persuaded Eli to go, or what happened that made Eli suddenly want to go.
Well, Mary Magdalene doesn't know that much.
Right.
And if she was writing a letter, she would include stuff about what's happened to them recently, wouldn't she?
Yeah. Yeah.
Difficult
but for the purposes
that.
Of fiction, you don't...
No, the letter needs to be the next scene, not the scene we've just seen, if you know what I mean. I think if she starts, "Dear Aunt Sugar, he lost all his money in the tent, the hoochie coochie tent or whatever," and then progresses the story a little bit rather, going back.
But then I have that whole scene where they stop and they discover the money's missing.
Right.
I don't know quite how to work it in, or maybe when she writes the letters, she can touch on it briefly, but because it's natural to tell her what they've been doing, but also find a way to just use it more as a way that she questions. And then when Aunt Sugar writes back, She's giving some news that she knows Mary Magdalene.
Well, also, you can just have Aunt Sugar's side of the correspondence if you want to use that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she can say, "Dear Mary Magdalene,
I was sorry to hear that Eli lost all your money."
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's a good idea.
That's a really good idea. You don't need both sides of the correspondence because we're getting the Mary Magdalene side of the story.
Yeah.
That's our main narrative, isn't it?
Now, that would really work, wouldn't it?
It would work better than this, certainly. But then again, where do I place that? I don't want to do Aunt Sugar's letter about, "I'm sorry you lost the money," before the chapter in which I reveal.
No, but you see, when Eli loses the money, Mary Magdalene's going to be livid and angry.
Right.
And I could just see her going, "I can't talk to you," and dashing off and writing, "Aunt Sugar, you'll never guess what he's done."
Yeah.
And then Aunt Sugar writing back saying, "I was sorry to get your letter and he is unreliable, but keep the faith," or whatever.
I think I could really see letters from Aunt Sugar dotted throughout the narrative, which would be really, really good, I think.
Mm. That would help me to get an adult's viewpoint as well.
Yeah. In the beginning, does she say goodbye to Aunt Sugar?
We haven't got the first chapter. I will have to write that in when they're actually leaving. And something about, just a narrative about the preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'll need to do something about the whispering going on that Madeline hears, but she doesn't understand.
Yeah, exactly. There's something going on she doesn't understand, but the reader might reader might understand from the information she gives us. Yeah.
And she could make a promise to write a certain, you know, sort of each time we stop, I'll get a letter to you or however that works.
Yeah.
I was a little bit, you know, I get worried about the technical bits.
Yeah.
I was a little bit worried about how they would know which town. Is she just going to go into each post office as they get to each town?
No, she was going to. She's going to.
I mean, even today, you can go online and Google this. If you, when people go around the world today, on the first leg of the journey, you'll write to a post office box in Hong Kong. And when they arrive in Hong Kong, they'll go and collect your letters for the last 3 weeks.
Right.
While you've been travelling around Asia.
Right.
And then they'll do it's called post restaurant.
Post restaurant,
yeah. And then, you know, you'll write to people in Hong Kong because you know that for the next 3 months they're on their way to Hong Kong. Mm. And then after a certain date, you start writing to an address in Australia.
I thought I would write general delivery and then she'll pick it up because they will go to the post office, will hold it general delivery and they'll pick it up. But I was working with a little concerned about how she's going to tell Aunt Sugar where they're going to be when, because it's an erratic kind of...
it doesn't have to be where they're going to be when. It can be, this is our route, these are the post offices on the way, and she could actually be disappointed. She could go to the first post office and say, "Have you got anything for me? My name's Mary Magdalene," and the guy says, "No, I haven't." And she could be really disappointed, and then at the next town she goes to the post office, and then eventually she gets to a post office and there is a letter from Aunt Sugar or something like that.
Or more than one. So it's something I have to work on, and it's not all figured out yet.
But I think, the idea of the letters, it gives you another voice.
Yes.
And another perspective.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Which I think could be really useful.
Yeah. And I think that the vehicle of the letters from Aunt Sugar is a wonderful way. You know, when we did the story planning the day with the index cards and stuff, Nicola, we talked about, you know, what's going to happen. There's this Elmo guy pass, etc. And I think having Aunt Sugar write along the way, it's a way to, she can kind of keep Eli informed about what's going on in a very subtle way.
Oh, because she knows Mary Magdalene will talk to him.
She'll probably read him.
Please tell Eli that the vicar's fine or something.
The vicar's fine.
Okay. Well, thank you all for the good advice and the comments. So,
I'll email mine to you.
Work.
And thank you.
But, you know, first I think I'm going to put the story grid to work and then work on it.
Okay, thank you, Linda. And over to Nicola.
Which leads nicely into... One of the things we did when Linda and I got together, which I found, because I'm a very visual person, was we took a sheet of paper and we divided it into one quarter, so drew a line vertically down at one quarter, then drew a line vertically down at a quarter towards the end. So, you know, you've got your three-act structure there. And what we then did was we wrote down the left-hand side the characters' names, didn't we? And we worked out what was going to what kind of a journey they were on, what kind of a hero's journey they were on, or were they on a redemption path, mm-hmm. or were they going through changes, or, you know, mm-hmm. trying to make themselves better or whatever. So then we placed when those things needed to happen at the end of the first act, the end of the second act, in accordance with the three-act structure.
Right.
And the thing I've learned this week is that you can also have two useful things going on that are called the external value and the internal value, and they should be opposite. Say, for example, that you're writing a thriller. The external value is going to be between life and death, except that there is apparently more nuances to it than that. There is life, unconscious life, there is death, and there's damnation. And then if you're writing a novel where you've got justice and injustice, for example, The Hunger Games, you would have justice, fairness, injustice, and tyranny. Mm-hmm. So you're stretching the just simple black and white things like love or hate into four things. And that apparently gives you a more nuanced story. And the idea is to decide which external value your story's got and which one you're going to work to, and start it so that it goes in a sort of an inverse bell curve, if you like. So right. If, say, for example, you're starting with life, you'd start at the top left. They start at life, then they go through unconscious, then they go to death, and then they go to damnation, then they come back up again. And the places where they cross the middle line is at the end of the first act, at the end of the second act.
Right.
And then you've got internal values. So what's your protagonist? What change are they going through? What's their internal value? So with mine, Brienne is selfish and self-absorbed, and she eventually realises that that's not where her salvation lies. She's going to become, you know, unselfish and realise that it's not all about love and being with the person you love. It's you can get pleasure from being with family and friends and not being so selfish. So that would be her internal value. And the idea is that if you're starting with a positive external value, say, for example, life that moves down into unconscious and then death, then your internal value is going in exactly the opposite way. So you've got a curve going down and then coming back up again. Then you've got a curve going up and then down again. And if they cross at the end of the first act and the second act, that unconsciously makes the reader feel very satisfied.
Right.
They're expecting certain things to happen at certain points in the story. And I thought that was quite a useful way to plot the arc or the curve of your stories.
Mm. Interesting.
But is that not saying then that, taking Brienne as your example, if she's starting off as selfish, self-obsessed, and that's down here,
yeah,
and she's going to go around about the middle, she's going to go up and become positive Pollyanna.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yeah.
And then, by the end of the novel, she's back down to being selfish,
exactly.
And self-obsessed.
No. It's a negative ending. So right. if you have the external value of life, then it goes down into death and damnation. That's the point of, you know, where all is lost moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it comes back up again.
Yeah.
The external value is coming back up into positive again. But she's going to be starting internally in a down place.
Yeah.
She'll be going up into the middle, which is the all is one moment for her.
Yeah.
And then she'll be going back down into a negative. So Clarice Starling, Silence of the Lambs, she starts off all positive,
mm-hmm.
and she goes down, you know, talking about the FBI being a fantastic place. That's all she wants to do. That's an external value. And she goes down into a place where she's disillusioned. Then she comes back up into the positive thing. And then she goes down into disillusionment again. And that's in the exact opposite to what the story's doing. You know, the victims and the manhunt for the killer. That's going in an exact opposite curve to what she's doing. And apparently that makes for a very nuanced book. And it's even an action thriller can be more exciting and more nuanced because of that.
Mm-hmm. And if that confused you a lot, or left you wondering what to do with the unconscious, I would suggest you go to the iTunes and look at least the five
videos, YouTube.
Films they have
YouTube,
there on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And do what they say, iTunes.
Yeah.
Well, you know me.
What I like about all of this is it can be drawn out on one sheet of paper.
Mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I love.
Mm-hmm. But it confuses me when we're just talking about it and I'm not seeing it. Go to YouTube and look for
the Story Grid.
Yeah. And you'll see these five videos that start to explain this.
Calm down.
That's enough. Okay.
A
Okay, thank you very much. Next, we're going to listen to Xander Cassell, Claire Lyman, and Catherine McNamara.
And Anne Landerman from Chimera Festival.
We're delighted to welcome Xander Cassell, Head of Digital at crowdfunded publisher Unbound, and Claire Hanscom, who's the author of Unscripted, which is due for release soon, published by Unbound. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hi there. Yes, great to be on.
Xander, perhaps we can talk to you first. Can you tell me briefly what you do at Unbound and how crowdfunded publishing works?
Of course. I am the head of digital, which is a little nebulous as a title, but in essence means that I'm in charge of all things digital here at Unbound. And day to day, I run a digital imprint or a digitally focused imprint, which is paperbacks and ebooks of mainly fiction, a little bit of nonfiction. And that is those are books that we publish into the trade in the UK. And we have a long now list of very wonderful authors and books that we've done over the last couple of years for that particular imprint. Unbound itself has been running for 8 years now. Unbound's community of 200,000 people from 195 countries have raised now over £7 million in crowdfunding, and that means that authors get to share their projects with a passionate and kind of committed audience of book lovers and book buyers. And it means that people also support projects beyond simply buying a copy of the book. They are able to pledge for rewards that include lunch with the author or a Skype book club call or similar kinds of exciting things. We take submissions and we commission books and we take on authors that we then crowdfund for the cost of producing the book. So an author comes to us through a submission process, say, and we'll say, that looks like a brilliant book, we'd love to do it. And an author will then put together a page with the synopsis and a short video talking about their book and an excerpt from their book and some reward levels for people. And that book then goes out to their friends and family and fans and readers. And that network of people crowdfunds the cost of producing that book, everything from the editorial costs through to the proofing and the design costs, costs of marketing, etc. So everything that's involved with producing the book and bringing it into the world is covered by the cost of the crowdfunding. As a normal publisher and produce the books and send them out to the warehouse and make sure that they're really distributed in all the relevant places, and we talk to all of the other companies you'd imagine are involved in the process of producing and distributing and marketing and selling books. We are open to everyone. We have a lot of agented authors. We're more than happy to work with agents as well as with unagented authors. Probably maybe 30% of authors have agents, but it's not a prerequisite at all. The way that crowdfunding succeeds best is always the network of the author that's going to bring the most people to the project. And so we're not necessarily looking to see whether you've got an agent. We're looking at your submission as a whole, as well as your ideas for crowdfunding and how we think the book will sit in the market. So we're looking at a sort of holistic thing when the submissions come in, but it's by no means essential to have an agent.
Claire, can we come to you now? Your book, Unscripted, is due out in a little while, isn't it?
Yeah, it's due out on the 4th of April.
Fantastic. And why did you decide that you wanted to crowdfund that?
So my book, Unscripted, had gone on submission from my agent in the US back in 2015. And I thought that getting an agent was the end of the journey. It turns out it wasn't. She didn't actually sell it. But even though it wasn't ultimately picked up, I got a lot of good feedback from editors at major publishing houses in New York. So I knew my book was good enough to be out there. I mean, I thought it probably was, but you always think that about your own book. So it was good to have the professional opinion. And I wanted to publish it with the prestige and professionalism of a publishing house rather than doing it myself. I thought my book stood more chance of garnering attention, the attention that I think it deserves that way. And Unbound offered to take on my book. And I've got good contacts and experience with crowdfunding other projects. So I went for it.
Tell us about your novel, Unscripted.
So Unscripted is about a young woman who is an aspiring writer and who has a pretty virulent celebrity crush on an American actor. And she's decided that she's going to get his attention by writing a novel basically about him and getting him to read it somehow and then offering to write the screenplay with him. And she's decided they're going to do this. They're going to fall in love and live happily ever after. So This may or may not go according to plan. You'll have to read the book to find out. But she does get to meet him. So it's not this crazy thing all in her head. There is definite interaction with the celebrity. But you'll have to read it and see.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
Now, I've had a look at your submission process. And yours is quite unusual, Xander, in that you're actually asking people to tell you why the story needs to be told, why you're the person to tell the story. You're actually going a bit deeper, aren't you?
Well, we're just looking to make sure we understand exactly why the book might work with us and why the book is the, you know, is going to suit the process as well as being a great piece of writing. And part of the reason we're going slightly deeper like that means that we can get a sense of whether this will work as something that can be pitched to readers straight away. Because, of course, all of the books that are crowdfunded are being pitched to people who might pledge before it's been through an edit or before it's been through a copy edit or a proof or anything like that. So it needs to, the idea needs to have some coherence to it so that it can be presented to a potential reader.
Can we talk a bit more specifically then? I mean, typically, how much money does an author need to raise to crowdfund a book?
We have a variety of different kinds of approach to books. The imprint that I run has a fixed budget for everyone that's very straightforward, and that's £5,500. There are other books on our site that have different production values or different production elements that make them more expensive to produce, whether they might be, for instance, hardbacks are more expensive to produce than the paperbacks that I produce on my list, and coffee table photographic books are vastly more expensive again to produce. So there are different levels of crowdfunding, and it also depends on the author to some extent. Sometimes we have authors that talk to us and have a huge fan network already, at which point we can make the best possible use of that and also the best possible format for their sort of fans. So it kind of depends on what the project is and where it fits. But in terms of what I do day to day and in terms of where most of our fiction sits, it's in the paperback originals, the digitally led imprint that I run, and that has a fixed budget of £5,500, which covers all of the costs involved.
Okay, so Claire, can you talk us through how you went about raising your money, the kind of package that you put together?
Yeah, so the first thing I did was I sent out group emails to my groups of friends who I knew didn't need much prodding, who I knew I could just send one email to a group of people and like 10 of them would pledge. And so my university friends, I sent them a group email because, you know, at the same time you can be like, hi everyone, hope everyone's well and all the new babies are doing well and sleeping through the night, blah, blah, blah. Here's a book. Please pledge for it. And then I also have a book club. So same thing with them. I emailed them as a group. And I also then did some kind of mass emailing of various contacts. That didn't work as well. What works the best is hounding people individually, emailing or Facebook messaging, actually, because I don't even have most people's email addresses these days, which is a bit of an obstacle, actually. It's kind of funny. You're like, oh, I'll just email everyone. Oh, I don't know anyone's emails. So yeah, Facebook messaging people individually and trying to figure out, do I know them well enough? Did I know them well enough at some point in the last 10 years? Do they like books? Because even if they don't like me or know me that well, maybe they really love books, or maybe they've got tons of money and desperate to spend it on a good cause. So yeah, so for each person, I sort of had to go through this mental arithmetic of, do I have enough of a friendship to ask this? And if they're going to be offended, is this a friendship that I want to lose? So yeah, so I did that. And then I also offered rewards, as Xander mentioned, that there's a different levels of rewards. If people have ever done Kickstarter, it's kind of similar to that. So yeah, mugs and t-shirts and tote bags and things like that. I think I'm the only person who's possibly ever done this, but I also offered some levels that didn't include the book that were literally just throw me £3 or £5 for these tiny rewards, like a playlist or yeah, things like that. So that meant that people who don't have any money or don't know me that well or don't care that much can like just shut me up by throwing a few pounds my way. So that helped a bit, I think, as well. Yeah, and then I also have a podcast and I have contacts in the industry. So I sort of used that as much as I could. I went on some podcasts to be interviewed and things like that. But honestly, I worked really, really hard at every possible angle like that. And what worked best, as Xander said, was emailing my own friends nicely, asking them to please support me. So,
yeah. So you need a big circle of family and friends.
You do. Yeah. I wrote a sort of tongue-in-cheek piece. I write for a website called Book Riot, which is a big book website in the US. And I wrote a tongue-in-cheek piece about how to crowdfund. And it was basically like, make sure you've moved around a lot and make sure you've made loads of friends in every place you've ever lived in. And then make sure you friend everyone on Facebook. Because 10 years later, when you crowdfund a book, you can get back to all those people. And yeah, I'm really lucky that I do have a wide range of friends and a wide range of friends that I've done meaningful things with. So even if I haven't spoken to them for a long time, there's enough of a bond somewhere back in our past that they're not, you know, they're not going to be annoyed that I'm emailing them.
We find that it takes about somewhere between 150 and 250 people to fund a book that's at the budget that we set for the paperback imprint. So as Claire's saying, you do need to mine your kind of connections and old friends and Facebook messages or direct emails do tend to work the best.
I mean, you've told us that the money spent on the editing process, the cover design, distribution, publicity, and all that kind of thing. But as a crowdfunding author, what do you think are the special skills, Claire, that you need above, and Xander, perhaps you can give your opinion on this too, above somebody that's picked up and taken off by a publishing house?
Well, that's a really interesting question because these days, most authors have to hustle quite a lot anyway to get anywhere marketing wise and things. You're going to have to email your friends anyway. It's just you're going to have to email them when your book's up for traditional pre-order rather than for unbound pledging. Maybe my friends get more emails like per book than traditionally published. But yeah, it's funny because a lot of what I was about to say, you need dogged determination, you need grit, and you need to be willing to put yourself out there, and you need to be creative. I mean, I've thought of as many creative ideas as possible to get my book out there. And I'm now currently, because my book's about to be published, so I'm I'm doing now what I would be doing anyway. And it's involving a lot of hard work and a lot of hustle and all that stuff. And I think in the end, it's kind of the same, but I kind of had to do it twice. So that means a lot of stamina and even more determination. And then you have to do it earlier. And I guess it is harder to get people to pledge for a book that doesn't exist yet than it is to get them to buy a book once it's actually finished and a finished product. On the other hand, you do have the shininess of you can be part of this and you can have your name in the book and please help me or this isn't going to happen. All those things are sort of helpful. So yeah, it's kind of the same, but more, I would say, as a traditional author.
Mm. Do you think there's something special about crowdfunded authors, Xander?
I think all of our authors are special. No, Claire's exactly right. In essence, exactly those same skills that are expected at any point now during a publishing process are the same kinds of things that are involved with the crowdfunding. Claire's been doing an amazing job recently on preparing for her launch and lining everything up internationally, not just in America, but also over here in London. And setting up all kinds of wonderful events and making sure that the updates through the Unbound site are going out to her pledgers, saying they can review it when it's out and on Goodreads before it's out, and they can tell people about the book in their book clubs and those sorts of things. So that kind of activity is absolutely the kind of thing that all publishers are looking for, really. And it is, in essence, yes, Claire's right, you kind of have to do that twice to some extent with Unbound, but what you end up with is a group of people. And when I can see from Claire's last update on the Unbound site, there's the 240 odd people who pledged for Claire's book are then a group of people that Claire can go to and say, right, here's the next thing you could do. Here, you're my marketing team. You can be my guerrilla group that goes out and tells everyone you know to really help be a launch team for the book. By corralling the group of people together on Unbound who help crowdfund the book, you have got a group of people in one place that you can then address in one go, and so kind of make sure that you're inviting them to book launches, or you're asking them to be part of a Facebook group, or you're saying, look, please go and review it. All that kind of all those kinds of things that help.
And do crowdfunded authors earn more per book than traditionally published authors?
Our split with authors is 50-50. So
wow.
All net profits are split 50-50, regardless of what where it comes from. And that is higher than a lot of publishers. There are now other digital publishers and other publishers that are doing a similar kind of thing. But all the net profits are 50-50 down the middle.
Wow. So Unscripted by Claire Hanscom, published by Unbound, out on the 4th of April.
Yes, that's perfect.
And Sandy, if people want to find Unbound and submit to you or pledge to help fund a book, how do they find you?
So you can go to unbound.com, and that's our homepage that has all kinds of information about the books that we are crowdfunding. It also has a little link at the top that says start a project. So if you want to submit, just click on that and it explains exactly what you need to do alongside the information you need to be able to submit to us. And there's a whole host of other info on the homepage, whether you're looking for, we have an online literary magazine that we run called Boundless. We have Backlisted, which is a podcast we run, which is nothing to do with Unbound books, but it's all about great backlist books. And there's FAQs, etc., all the things you'd expect.
That's marvellous. Thank you very much, both of you. That's been really useful.
Thank you. Thank you both. That's very kind of you.
Bye.
Thanks very much.
So today I'm delighted to be joined by Anne Landman, who is the original creator of Chimera, which is Scotland's festival of science fiction, fantasy and horror writing. And Anne had the idea for the festival, and actually I believe you wrote the business plan as part of your dissertation for your MA, is that right?
I did, yes.
So how did the idea come to you originally? What were you doing? Are you a sci-fi fan? And how did you go about getting the idea off the ground? Quite quickly, I understand.
Well, I'm a big sci-fi fantasy reader, and I live in Edinburgh, which obviously is the home to one of the world's best literary festivals, the Edinburgh International Book Festival, which is always a fantastic programme, but a bit slim pickings when it comes to my favourite genre. So we decided to just start our own festival. I've got a background in events management for literary festivals, and so we already had the knowledge. We just decided that we'd give to get a bit of kind of starting money, because you have to pay things like website hosting and marketing, we'll do a crowdfunder. And also to kind of see if we get the interest in the community and get the first kind of tickets sold. And because it's a book festival, all our events will be single tickets, unlike conventions where you buy your day pass. But we also wanted to use the crowdfunder to offer weekend passes. So the crowdfunder was the only way you could buy a weekend pass. It was also to see if people would trust us, because they still haven't seen the program. We've released about 20 writer names, so 20 authors that are joining us out of the 70 we are going to have. And they've got like a vague idea of what we're going to do. There's like bits and balls we've announced, like the Creators Hall, and we're having the Shoreline of Infinity and Horizon, which is a kind of sci-fi cabaret. And Shoreline of Infinity is an award-winning magazine based right here in Edinburgh. And we're going to have a quiz and a Kaylee. So that's all things we were telling people about to kind of entice them. And we just wanted to see if people took us up on it. And I think we ended up with about 60 people signing up for a weekend pass for a festival that has never happened before. So that was amazing.
Amazing. I mean, I'm a quick start in life. You know, I'm one of these people who has an idea and gets them up and running. So I'm full of admiration for you. I'm also come from a software and marketing background. And one of the most important things is to get an idea in front of the potential people who it's for. And like you say, test the water and see if there's any enthusiasm and groundswell of support. And it certainly seems that your crowdfunder proved that.
Definitely. I mean, we set the initial target because I ran some figures. I was kind of, you just take a stab in the dark. And we were looking for £3,500, which we smashed. And then the stretch target was 5, and we surpassed that. So it's just amazing.
I understand you set it up as a charity now.
We felt it was important for it to give the festival longevity, not to have it as a one-off idea. Charity status helps with a lot of things, never mind tax. But we also want to apply for further funding from kind of governmental bodies. Having the charity status really helps with that. We were really lucky. There's a fantastic organization that helps people that want to set up a charity to fill in all the forms. And they were brilliant. So we got it off the ground actually really quickly.
So, okay, so you had the idea. You got the crowdfunding thing up. You started contacting authors. You got a fantastic response from authors. And so the whole thing is over a weekend, is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of Friday afternoon, Saturday, Sunday.
So yeah. People should, if they want to find out about the festival itself, which website should they visit?
So the website is chimerafestival.co.uk, and Chimera is spelled C-Y-M-E-R-A, and then festival.co.uk. Fantastic. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook. I might get an Instagram off the ground eventually.
Well, perhaps you need a volunteer to do that. So you found the actual process of getting it up onto the crowdfunding website quite simple?
Yeah, it was very straightforward. We used crowdfund.co.uk, which is, I didn't want it to be Kickstarter because I felt, Kickstarter, Crowdfunder is kind of the two, GoFundMe is the other one, isn't it? I just felt Crowdfunder kind of felt a better fit for us. Crowdfunder kind of, it's the spirit of, a lot of the festival is about community and people socializing together and finding their tribe, basically.
Yeah.
Having Crowdfunder in the actual name just felt a more natural fit for us. Website was dead easy to use. We had to put, I really wanted it because I wanted it for the weekend passes. We had other rewards. So we found ideas for rewards round. We gave them some cool names. I still think they're cool, even if no one knows what a stallworm is. You've got to cost your swag as well.
Yes.
All the things you give away, which was really important to think about. Because out of those £5,800 we raised, we obviously don't get all of that because you pay your fee. Although that's quite, we got more out than I thought we would. Then you have to cost your reward.
Yep.
So you've got to be realistic about how much of the money you've raised you're actually going to get. You've got to reserve it for, like, I now have to print bags and make enamel badges, which I have to take into account. So not all the money we've raised is for spending. But I still think it's a great way of reaching out to the community, getting them involved early on. They can leave comments, which is really nice if you're having a stressful day and you just want some really positive feedback. Just go onto the Crowdfunder comments and it will totally cheer you up.
Yeah, fantastic. Great stuff. And, of course, you've gained another skill under your belt there. You could actually coach other people through setting up festivals and crowdfunding them, couldn't you?
Oh, my God, yes. If there's any other crazy people out there. I mean, obviously, don't ask me until July.
No.
But at that point, I'd be delighted to talk to you over a cup of coffee.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
How you get this nonsense off the ground.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you, Anne. I really appreciate you responding so quickly and getting involved. And I'm looking forward to showcasing the Chimera Festival on Right Club.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're delighted to welcome Catherine McNamara, author of the novel The Divorced Lady's Companion to Living in Italy, the short story collection Pelt and Other Stories, and The Cartography of Others. Welcome, Catherine. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks very much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Catherine, your first two books were traditionally published. Why did you decide to crowdfund your recent collection, The Cartography of Others?
Well, it's always a long story trying to get a short story collection published. The first book was an erotic comedy, so I did sort of find my way into traditional publishing without an agent. And I think that's because of the material, and it sort of sold quite well. But in my second collection, I sort of returned to what my passion really is, and that's short story writing. And you probably all know how difficult it is to publish a short story collection. So I sort of had that published with the same publisher, but on the strength of me being able to sell the other book, meaning I did a lot of promotion myself, a lot of blogging, and as many events and festivals as I could, really. And so that's how that sort of collection came into being with a small publisher. This collection that came out last year now, I've since acquired an agent, and so things change, and the stories have all been published, and some of them have won prizes, and so the material was sort of already out there. But the same argument applies. It's very hard to get a short story collection published. Almost impossible if you're not sort of, I don't know, the flavour of the day or something. We did try with all of the traditional publishers, and they were keen and positive, but they really wanted a novel, to be honest. And so we looked into Unbound. That's my crowdfunding publisher. We looked into Unbound. They were very interested in the manuscript, and we thought, well, I'm talking about we, meaning myself and my agent, we decided we'd give it a go and see. That's how it all happened. I really knew nothing about the process when I started.
So how does it work? Where do you start?
Yeah, it's quite a big thing to take on, being realistic. And I'm very glad that I did it, but it's hard work. But not that publishing with a small publisher is easy. There's nothing easy about publishing a book, I don't think. First of all, I sort of had to prove to my particular publisher that I had quite a strong social media platform. That's very, very important, and that's what they're looking for, I think, regardless of who you're publishing with, you have to have a presence. and energy. You have to have that type of energy and not be afraid of being public. And I'd had two blogs running with my first two books, and so I had quite a lot of followers, and I was used to talking to people and making a little bit of noise. So I think that helped and gave me a bit of confidence that I'd actually have people to contact, because it's up to you raising funds, really. I mean, you are given a time frame, and the time frame with Unbound is 90 days. If you don't get to your target within 90 days, that can be easily extended. It's not as if, you know, everything falls apart. And you decide whether you want to go with a paperback or a hardback. Obviously, with a hardback, you have to earn a lot more, bring in a lot more money. And this target goes towards publishing the first edition of your book and the editing and everything that's involved with that. And with my particular book, we'll get onto that later, it was very high quality, so I'm very happy with that. Anything that you do raise above your target goes towards the trade edition, and you do get 50% of that. So money begins to come back to you after you sort of reached your target and the book's out there in the world. So, okay, when you do sign up, a fun thing to do, I found it a lot of fun, but I guess it could be daunting. You present yourself in a little video, and if anybody wants to have a laugh, you can look at my Unbound video. Just look up Catherine McNamara Unbound and the title of my book, and you can see the video that I made at home using my iPhone and editing skills, and it's okay, it's fine. I had a lot of fun doing that. Along the way, I picked up a lot of hints from other people who I knew who'd already published with Unbound, in particular people who were sort of trying to put short story collections together. And some people had had good experiences and some people had had terrible experiences. But I decided right from the beginning that I was going to focus on good things and make it into a positive experience, not something that I was going to complain about. So I won't really be complaining about it. It's a lot of hard work. Moving on to sort of how you actually get the money from people's thoughts, you know, into Unbound. I mean, their website obviously works very well, but you do have to approach everybody yourself, and you have to explain the model and explain not so much buy my book, give me money, because that's not the right way to approach people, I think. I have a project. Are you interested in coming on this journey with me towards publication? I'm trying to get people to believe in this project. If you're interested, I would appreciate your interest, and you could order a copy of the book that will be produced. So it sort of works like that. You've got to sell yourself, but in a literary way, in a bookish way. So obviously approaching people who like you, like your work, or once you're finished with your family and friends, then it really becomes crowdfunding, because you have to approach the crowd, I mean, the unknown. Yeah, that's when you have to be daring.
What do your supporters get in return?
There were some people who actually said, I can't afford to buy a book, and can I just make a contribution? So that would be the lowest level. Then obviously an ebook or a book, package of books, or you can make your sort of project more interesting by inventing things to. So you offer a series of rewards, really. And one of the things that I offered was a day in Venice, and a couple of people came for that, and so that bumped up their contribution quite a bit. A couple of other writers came to my house. I offered a writing retreat in my house, so that was a week of working or editing on a project, and that obviously was rather pricey, so that brought up their contribution. No, quite a few things worked. I mean, people were prepared to help, and short story workshops and book clubs, that's other things. And I know other writers were offering mentoring. I think I did that too. You just got to use your imagination and be a tiny bit different, and also check out what everybody else is doing, obviously, and seeing how you can, yeah, how you can trigger people's interest.
So how long did it take you to reach your target?
I did it within 90 days. I worked really hard. And I know that was one of your questions, how. I mean, I did use Facebook Direct Messenger. I have a lot of followers on Facebook, so that helps a lot. But I tailored every single message. I didn't send out, you know, a chunk paste and copy and paste. I didn't do that because I think that is a bit rude, really, especially if I don't know people very well. Twitter, direct message. And I wasn't really on Instagram then, so I didn't use that. And I didn't really use direct email. I did Facebook most of the time.
So email and Facebook was the primary route?
For me, yes. It might be different people, but for me, but in the past I've sort of also, like, as I said, I had two very active blogs going for a couple of years, and I've always sort of gone to festivals in London, writing festivals, and always tried to network and stay in touch with people and that type of thing. I think the more you give, the more you get back. It's the same with everything.
And the money that you raise then goes to physically produce the book. Yeah. And do you get a share of the profits after that?
After the target, then everything is 50%. What you raise beyond the target, and then the sales afterwards, ebook and hard copy, obviously, everything is 50%, which is a pretty good deal, but you do have to sell copies.
So you had a manuscript complete. You took it to Unbound. You said, I can market it through my blogs and this way. They said, yes, we'll do it. Did they just take the book as was, or was there an editing process or a review process?
First of all, they reviewed the book and they accepted the book and they enjoyed the book. So that was, you know, the first step really was having it accepted. The editing process was extensive. It was really, really long. And I think it was very, very well done. I mean, we went through a structural edit, copy edit and a line edit with three different people, even four different people, I think. It was very, very, very well done.
Right. And those were people that work at Unbound.
Yeah. I don't know if they're in-house or freelance. I really don't know. But they were very capable, very professional, and it was hard work. It was endless.
But then with any publishing, you're going to have that edit process, aren't you? So there is a kind of, there are really what I'm trying to establish, that there were sort of checks and balances along the way. It's not like self-publishing. It's not like they've got a platform to help you raise the money and then you self-publish whatever you like. No.
No, okay. You're not going to come out with any clangers or anything like that. I think they're very professional.
Yeah.
There's no risk to anything like that. Once it's gone through three editors, I mean, it's very well put together.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And were you involved in the cover design for the book?
I approved. I mean, I could make a choice. I was given some designs and I made a choice, and I'm actually very, very happy with the cover design.
And then in terms of distribution of that book compared to working with a small publisher, how was that?
It's hard. It's not easy. Also because I did the sort of cheaper option, if you like, because I didn't do the hardback. I went for paperback because I was a bit daunted by raising almost double the figure. I didn't know that I could have a lot of money. And I didn't want to be having nervous breakdown over that. They put more effort into distributing hardback books, obviously, more than they do with the paperback. So that's been a bit of a struggle, I think. You do as much as you can to get it into Waterstones. I mean, it's on all of their database, but it's not necessarily in all of their shops. So I've done a lot of appealing and letters and everything. And the same goes for reviews. I've done most of the reviews on hunting myself, and that applies to the small publisher situation as well. You've really got to hunt for reviews. That's not easy. Definitely not easy.
With your next book, are you going to go with Unbound or are you going to go back to the small traditional publisher?
I have quite a few publishers who were interested in the way that I write, so my hope is that with a novel they might take it through. I'd be very happy. And my agent is waiting for a novel, so that's what I'm working on now. I feel as though I'm betraying the short story form, but as soon as I can, I'll get back to writing short stories.
That's interesting.
Also, I mean, I'm enjoying the process, but it's a completely different process. I'm sure you'll know that anyway.
That's been really useful from my point of view. I've got lots of great information there. I will go and look at your video, and may we put the link to your video on our Facebook group?
Yes, you can put anything out there. And if anyone wants to follow me on Facebook or anything like that, I'm always happy to talk. I'm on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, and I'm quite active. On Facebook, I'm Catherine McNamara, and on Twitter, I'm @CatInItaly. And Instagram, exactly the same thing.
That's excellent. Thanks very much indeed, Catherine. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you. That was really interesting.
And yeah, it was. And good luck with the rest of the novel.
Okay, thank you. That means we've all got an awful lot to learn. We're going to get our books published.
I thought it was interesting, one of the things that Catherine mentioned there, it's very difficult to get a short story collection published unless you're, you know, one of the top, known as a top writer of short fiction. So, you know, as one of the reasons she went to Unbound on this occasion. So I thought that was quite interesting for anybody who's working on short stories. Mm. Might want to bear that in mind.
Mm, yeah. A lot to take in.
Yeah. Mm. And her book, The Cartography of Others, which are very literary short stories, very good, It's last time I looked, it was 99p on Kindle, if anybody wants to try that.
Supporter there, yes. That was interesting because I looked at it as well, and I've seen science fiction quality on there. It looks absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And quite a few name authors are now publishing on there, aren't they?
Yes, and if you don't want to subscribe for yourself, what a great gift idea.
Yeah. I've bought it as gifts.
Yeah.
I've bought gifts for people. Mm.
Yeah.
So they get a first edition of the book when it comes out.
Yeah. Lovely.
So you can still buy on Unbound even when it's been funded, and then you can go over and buy on Amazon as well.
Yeah. Because then it goes into the normal channels, the normal book channels.
Well, I think it's very
Unbound is the publisher. Yeah.
Yeah. We're almost at the end of our podcast, but first, Teresa is going to tell us what's on her bedside table.
Well, actually, I'm reading at the moment Portrait of the Artist as a Young Dog by Dylan Thomas, which are just brilliant short stories and really take you back in time to the time, you know, when he was a child and people had coal holes and the maid hung the washing out and all of that. Obviously, the title is a little bit of a poke at James Joyce, isn't it? Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. But there's a real honesty to these stories and a real sense of fun and wonder. I mean, one of them that I just read, it's about two servant girls who've been walking out with the same young man. So one of them has a Wednesday afternoon off and the other has a Friday afternoon, and they've just met and realised that they're dating the same guy. And the servant is looking after the young Dylan. So they go to the park in a snowstorm to meet this guy and confront him. And it's great, you know, the way that, you know, the child really has no clue what's going on or why they're making such a fuss about all this. He just wants to make a snowman and things. But beautifully written, lovely, delightful stories.
Mm. Thank you. So, Patsy Collins, what's on your bedside table?
The book is called The Quiet Side of Passion. Lovely title, isn't it, to have on bedside? I would have picked it up just on that title, I think, but the main reason I picked it up is because it's by Alexander McCall Smith, and I've never come across a book of his that I didn't like. This one is in the Isabel Dalhousie series. I don't know if you've read it, but she's a philosopher, and she makes her life very complicated for herself, which is it's good. I can kind of relate to the character in that she keeps trying to do the right thing. She usually gets there, but there's quite a lot of deviations along the way. I'd read any of Alexander McCall Smith's books, and this is a long series. I realised when I picked this up that extra characters have appeared, so I've obviously missed a couple, so I'll go back and read those. But it's it is an ongoing story, but they're not the sort of books that would matter if you didn't start from one and work all the way through. They all work. Coincidentally, I was reading last night and I read a bit that I thought was really good. When I put the book down to talk to you about it, I realised there's a bit of an extract on the back which I hadn't looked at because I knew I'd love the book anyway. I didn't need to read the book. It's Isabel's husband, Jamie, and her in a conversation. And it says, "You do know," said Jamie, "that I always approve of everything you do, everything." She laughed. "I wouldn't recommend that." I really love that. I just happened to have read it last night, but I thought, what a lovely thing. He's being so supportive in the room. I think so many happy relationships work like that. They try and be supportive to each other, but then the other one's thinking, oh, you know, maybe that's a bad idea. So I'd recommend any of his books, but as I'm halfway through this one, this is particularly good. You know, maybe go back and start. I also love his the number one lady detective agency books. They're really good. Somebody actually paid me a huge compliment. They said that they felt my writing was similar in style to his. And I was absolutely delighted. Alexander McCall Smith, he writes on all kinds of things. I mean, he writes about Botswana that I don't know about. He writes about the life of a philosopher, which I don't know about. But it's very accessible. You can believe in these characters, and they're always going off and thinking sidetracks and all different kinds of things and get distracted through life. They're not just on the plot of the story. They're having real lives, and I love that. And they're very good. And also, you know, although you're getting engrossed in the story, when you get tired, you can put it down and pick it up tomorrow and you'll still be able to get back into it easily. And they don't give you nightmares and things, so ideal for time reading.
Yes.
Thank you, Patsy. Now, have you got your ticket to the Manny in October this year to come to the Lit Fest?
I have.
Yep.
Absolutely.
We'll see you all there. So that was Right Club, the podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher or Radio Public so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Join our Facebook group. Just search for Right Club, the podcast. Please leave a 5-star review and tell all your friends about us. Bye.
Bye. Bye.